Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
React in a positive way. We need positivity for this second half. Positivity, believe, positivity, believe. 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 Positivity, believe, positivity, believe.
Hello, X-Subs. And maybe general extra inch listeners. I haven't decided yet if this is going to go out on the main feed, because normally we keep our guest under wraps because he's very special. Alex Doyle, it's lovely to have you back. Our resident, as I call him, sports psychologist. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me back, and congratulations and happy birthday.
Thank you very much. Yeah, everything's happening at once this year for me. It's been a big year so far. When I told the X-Subs that we were having you back on and to send in any questions, I got some amazing comments and feedback. People were very, very pleased. They love these episodes because they're hearing something different and obviously from someone who's an expert. But for anyone who's not heard you before, would you mind just giving a brief background? I know I ask you to do this every time and it must be very infuriating, but it's good to hear your credentials.
Thank you. No problem. Always happy to talk about myself. I'm officially a sports psychologist in training while I'm finishing a doctorate, but I work as a sports psychologist across a number of different sports with different individuals, and I'm currently doing a doctorate in at the University of Portsmouth, which is looking at a couple of areas. So was looking at a bit of kind of choking under pressure or sort of bottling it essentially, and now also actually working a little bit more on sort of transitions of kind of junior athletes to sort of making it in the senior ranks. A bit of a new topic there, a bit of new information for the listeners.
Nice. A new addition. Interesting pivot, and we'll tie in nicely with one of our questions that we've got lined up for this pod. And the other thing, most importantly, is that you're a long-standing Spurs fan. Am I right in thinking previous season ticket holder?
Correct, yes. Yeah, so I've really frustratingly, this is the first season I've not had a season ticket in a while, which was due mostly to having a young daughter, so I just wasn't getting to the games on time. But it is quite annoying that I had a season ticket through all of the last couple of managers, and then have now given it up just as we're playing really exciting, really interesting football again.
So, oh man, yeah, that must be,
that's life.
That must be frustrating. Yeah. Such is life, as you say. So Alex, let's get started with some of the questions that our X-Subs have sent in, which are brilliant. In fact, first, I will allow you to talk for as long as you like about Ange, because we haven't done this yet. We haven't had a chance to speak about Ange. We spoke lots about Mourinho. We spoke lots about Antonio Conte. But this is a completely new style of coaching and man management. Have you got any kind of broad brushstroke thoughts on Ange and his approach?
Yeah, I love him. That's it. We can end the recording. When I kind of got in touch and said, hey, I'd love to come back on, I literally specifically said, like, I'd been kind of waiting, because through the first however many games it was, dozen or so, I didn't really feel like I had much to contribute other than to say I think he's just brilliant in basically every way. I think there's just a huge amount, that from a sort of a sports psychology perspective is just really, really impressive about him. And I think it kind of goes to show that often sports psychology is broadly kind of in line with common sense and a lot of people's intuition as well. That, you know, a lot of the things that I think most Spurs fans really like about him are also the things that, with my sort of professional hat on, I also really like about him. I think there's just a sort of an air of authenticity that really is just like extremely obvious. And I think that makes it really, really easy to like him both as a fan, but also I think from that sort of psychology perspective, like makes him very easy to buy into as a player. And I think he's also, as part of that, I think he has, you get the sense that if he was making a hard selection decision and had to choose, you know, who he was playing in a certain position, you get the feeling that he would be very upfront, you know, in making that kind of announcement and talking to the person who was potentially coming out the sort of the wrong side of that decision. He would do a really nice job of putting that to them in a sort of, in a way that was very understanding, but also was like true, you know, that was like, listen, I'm going with so-and-so today because this and this. That doesn't mean you're rubbish, or, you know, and there will probably be, you know, potentially there's a role for you off the bench or whatever. You know, you kind of get the sense that he would put that across in a way that would be, yeah, very psychologically beneficial to kind of keeping that person motivated and engaged and all the rest of it. So yeah, I've been very impressed with him. I'd seen various bits and pieces of him at Celtic and things, and had always been impressed there. I really like, it's a kind of a line that he's used a few times of sort of talking about the difference between like what fans can and should expect. So sort of when people are kind of like, you know, should the fans get excited? That was probably the first video where he really kind of caught my attention, was that he was asked that in a press conference when he was at Celtic. And he sort of said like, yeah, the fans should get carried away. The fans should get excited because that's their job. But but then he sort of brought it back to, but our job is very different, you know, and we have to sort of prepare for this not just being a walkover or whatever. You know, when you're Celtic in the Scottish League, you probably have a little bit more sort of capacity for maybe complacency or whatever. But yeah, I loved the way that he sort of differentiated that, because I think all too often that line gets a little bit blurred, and you do definitely have managers who sort of act more like fans in some ways, of kind of trying to sort of G up people and kind of get that sense of sort of excitement or expectation behind them. But that's also then a double-edged sword, because if it doesn't go your way, then you potentially look foolish off the back of that as the manager. So yeah, I've been incredibly impressed by a lot of what he said. And, you know, even I think through the course of this season, the way that he has sort of tempered expectations at various points, been really authentic in his assessment of things. He is very good. Another thing I like about him is that he's very good at sort of accepting responsibility himself, you know, and you know, certainly for a period of time after that kind of horrific sort of slightly traumatizing Chelsea game, you know, there were plenty of opportunities when he could have passed the buck and he could have said, oh, well, this is because of injuries. Oh, this is because of suspensions. And he basically never did that. And actually, even in some press conferences, you know, was given questions that would have given him a really easy out, you know, the questions that were specifically framed around, oh, well, is this because of injuries? And he has kind of almost purposefully sort of shunned that line of thinking and gone, no, like at the end of the day, this is my job. I'm the manager. I pick the team and I pick a team that I think is going to win. Like, and I just really, really respect that, again, as a sort of an individual, but also as a sports, like, I think that really speaks to a certain sort of integrity and authenticity that will be recognized by the players and which will make them more motivated, more incentivized, more kind of bought into the plan.
Just music to my ears that yes, we love him, and also we're right to love him is the message I'm getting. A couple of points on the really interesting point you raised about team selection and how he might handle that. So we, just for context, we're recording on the 9th of February ahead of the Brighton match, and he specifically mentioned something in his pre-match press conference that I think relates to this. Obviously, we've got Bissouma coming back from the African Cup of Nations. Saar is already back. Maddison has returned from injury. So suddenly, we've gone from being bare bones in midfield to having a plethora of options. And he has, really interestingly, I think, essentially said, I've got a bunch of midfielders, each with different skill sets, who all suit different purposes. And I think he's doing that and being very open about that, specifically for the reason you cited, so that he can say to players when they're not picked, well, I want to pick X player today because I need someone to hold the ball and beat the press or play long passes over the top or, I don't know, drop deep and split the centre backs, whatever reason it might be, run box to box all game. There's a whole host of different characteristics amongst the midfielders, and he's given himself, in making this really apparent to the press, permission to have those conversations with the players, which I think is really interesting. And also there's so much kind of Ange material out there from his previous roles, because although he might not have been Mr. Famous, he has always been an interesting character. And so people have always wanted to talk to him. And so there's lots of interviews. And one of them I heard involved him describing how he doesn't like to get too close to players and too friendly with players, specifically because when he has to make those decisions around team selection, if he has a friendship with one player and not another, he might be biased. And he recognizes that removing those biases helps him make a more objective decision. And oh my goodness, it was so good to hear that said in that way. Because often it feels quite nice when you see coaches and managers being matey with players and having little special relationships with certain players. And as fans, it gives us a kick to see those behind the scenes videos where the manager's got his arm around a certain player every week and it's like, oh, he Poch just loves Harry Kane or Ryan Mason or whoever it might be. But actually, Ange has sort of shown us a different way, and I kind of prefer that way.
Yeah, and I completely agree. I think it's kind of, again, it sort of probably touches on that sort of, there's something quite common sense about that of like, well, if you're in that position of power where you are selecting the team, it's not going to necessarily be great for the team dynamic if, you know, particularly, you know, the risk is if almost by coincidence, just because of the sort of personality types, you become quite friendly with, let's say it's Bentancur, right? And then all of a sudden that means that one of Bissouma and Sarr is probably missing out, right? Well, if you're the one who then gets dropped that match, are you sitting there going, well, it's just because he's matey with Bentancur? Even if it's actually got nothing to do with that, it's just that for the moment he's deemed to be the better player or because of the specific circumstances of who we're playing in the next match. It's a really kind of quick and easy way to start sort of sowing a little bit of kind of resentment or discontent within the group where people feel like that. But I think it's also important to notice that, like, although he says that, and I believe that to be true, and that he keeps a professional distance, but he is also clearly quite connected to a lot of the players and does make a lot of effort. So, you know, we did have the charming video of him, you know, welcoming our new signings and stuff through January and kind of coming over, and, you know, there was all the sort of like the Bardi's going to come and get me, but all the ITK of kind of like certain deals being done because Ange was sort of calling the players and convincing them and things like that. So he clearly has a really strong rapport. Yeah. I think he just tries to keep that rapport very similar across the board. So like he is very willing to come over and say kind things and put an arm around someone, but he would do that in, I think he's almost actively trying to cultivate the fact that he does that in an almost identical, very similar way from one player to the other. And that's where I think the fact that he's also gives off this sense of authenticity is really important, because you could very easily come unstuck if you were just saying the same thing to every person in a very similar way. That could come across as very fake very quickly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think I suspect what he gets right is he tweaks the language slightly. He maybe does it in a slightly different way, but I think the way that he goes about it, he's not clearly closer to some players than others. And because there is this kind of like, he just speaks quite, you know, from the hip, quite authentically, quite honestly, I suspect what he actually says to each player kind of resonates with them individually quite well. But you also do get a sense that like, oh, okay, yeah, like he's not either kind of blowing smoke and trying to make me feel better about myself and, you know, and I don't believe him, or he's making stuff up because he's about to drop me. Yeah, like I think there probably is a sense there. And that's a really, really difficult balance to strike, particularly, you know, in a sport like football where you've got, obviously, you know, it's not like an individual sport where what you say to one particular player only really impacts them, right? When you've got to manage a squad and those decisions of who starts and who doesn't and who's on the bench and who isn't, when are you bringing people back from injury and all the rest of it? Like, there are really tricky decisions in that. And I think just being upfront about a lot of it is a really, really helpful way to go.
Nice. So I will start with some questions now.
Can I interrupt just before we do that? Because there is one really teeny tiny little observation that I love about Ange, and it's kind of particularly relevant because it's obviously the snippet that's used in the theme for the show, is the thing I love most about that enjoy your lunch talk, right? Which feels like it could have been like a Hollywood script, right? But the thing I absolutely love most about it, I love everything. I like that it happens at lunch the most, because actually one of the things that I think is really underrated in basically all sports is like that sort of pre-competition routine and the getting each player to sort of be in their own sort of optimal state. And actually I could imagine if you gave that speech 5 minutes before kickoff, for some players it might be almost ruinous. Because it's all about like, go out there, you're not just representing yourself, you're representing your friends, your family, the people closest to you, the people who sacrificed. For some people, that sense of pressure could be really unhelpful and could be like really, really adverse for their performance. So actually the fact that he says it clearly at lunchtime, right? So you got to assume that's at least hours before they would be playing or whatever, right? So he's saying that, he's setting out his stall of like, listen, these are the values that are important to me. And I think these are values that you guys can also sort of respect and use as motivation. But he's not doing it 5 minutes before. People have that time to process it and go away and kind of like, let them the message sink in, but then also go about getting ready for whatever the match was in their own way, in their own time, to get themselves into that own headspace that's going to work right for them. And I think, yeah, that for me is actually the bit that's almost most impressive. It's not just how brilliantly worded it is, but it's the timing of it as well.
That's really fascinating. And yes, I imagine deliberate. It's hard to know for sure, isn't it, whether it was deliberate or not, but it feels like it would have been deliberate, and does, as you say, give time for players who might be slightly overwhelmed by the pressure to kind of calm down and then do what they need to do pre-match to take the pressure off and kind of get in their own zone, as it were. I hadn't thought of that in that way at all, so that's a really fascinating insight. So Brian David says, firstly, I always love the conversations with Alex. I'm looking forward to another podcast with him. Frank, thank you very much, Brian. He says, we've had a number of injuries this season, and I wonder if Alex has any insight into how sports psychology might mitigate the mental effects of repeated injury layoffs, both for the injured players and their teammates who must deal with changing teams and demoralized teammates. And yeah, we kind of heard snippets of this season. The impact of players going away has had on the teammates. For example, Son being away at the Asian Games and Romero supposedly stepping up to the plate and being the one to go and check in on all the players in Son's absence. I really like that insight. Also, the idea of Bentancur just repeatedly banging on Ange's door, begging to be brought back into the fold, even when he wasn't quite ready, I think tells something about how difficult he found it being away from the group. And obviously he's still socializing and spending time with them in the training center, but it's not the same as being on the training pitch with them. So any insight you can offer on how sports psychology can mitigate the mental effects, as Brian puts it?
Yeah, it's definitely a topic that a lot of sports psychologists work on. Like, it's sort of one of the kind of the core ones, although it's often somewhat overlooked because it obviously only applies in very specific circumstances when you have someone who's injured. It's really hard, and I think for those players who have suffered from kind of like those really long-term injuries, it can be really destabilizing. A lot of the time, as with most psychology, there's definitely a sense of kind of, there isn't going to be a one size fits all policy for that, and actually someone, on the one hand, to your question there about sort of Bentancur and kind of going and knocking on the door and all the rest of it, right, is like, some players will be like that. They will be chomping at the bit, desperate to get back. But for others, and it may actually be quite an intimidating process, of almost like, am I fully ready? And you might have players who, the rest of the sports science team, the doctors, the physios, all the rest of it, are going like, no, they're good to go. Like, what's the hang up here? But actually they may just not feel like they can trust their body yet. And there may also obviously be fears of like, particularly, it's a fear that's been voiced on the pod, right? Of like, is Bentancur going to come back and be the player he was? Is Van de Ven, I mean, it looks like so far, touch wood, he has been, but coming back from a hamstring injury when pace is like such a core component of his game, right? Like, is he, it's not hard to imagine that he might now, every time he turns and has to sprint to cover back, is that little kind of voice in the back of his head going, is your hamstring going to go again, right? Like, and that's where the sort of sports psychology comes in, is not just managing the potential frustrations of the rehab process and trying to sort of stay focused. That tends to be around sort of staying very kind of process driven, step by step, like, what are we doing today to get you back where you want to be, by whatever the deadline is. And it becomes very kind of just like, okay, let's celebrate the little wins along the way. You know, like, let's take pride in that, because for a lot of people, you know, a lot of these athletes, right, professional footballers will have been playing football like an unbelievable number of hours a week, or training or playing or whatever, from a very, very, very young age. If you take that away, that's hugely disruptive. And for a lot of them, you know, very understandably, their self-esteem, their identity, their morale, their confidence, all the rest of it will probably be pretty closely linked to their performance in training, their performance on the pitch at, you know, during matches. And so when you remove that, there's this huge void potentially that you're trying to fill, and you're trying to kind of reframe, okay, well, all right, cool. Like, you were able to do a hamstring curl with, like, unweighted, but you could do a hamstring curl today for the first time in 2 weeks. Like, that's a huge victory in the rehab process, but that's not going to be the same kind of currency almost,
yeah,
of what they've been used to celebrating and used to be, you know, used to kind of deriving their sense of worth and identity and value and all the rest beforehand. So there's often work around that of just trying to sort of like find those little wins and making sure that they are really celebrating them and taking them for what they are and building the sort of sense of confidence and self-esteem out of that while that's going on. That then also helps with the transition process, right? Because if you've been kind of building that confidence and building that self-esteem of like, yeah, okay, this isn't what you would have liked to have been doing, but hey, you did a hamstring curl today for the first time or whatever. Like, you can go from there to, okay, well, we've been tracking your progress. We know that this is where you started post-injury. We've been watching you kind of get better and better and better. That can help give that sense of confidence then when it is time to return that, yeah, you really have done everything that's been asked of you. You've been noticing that, you've been paying attention to that and celebrating that, so that when you are then called on, you know, to come off the bench for your first appearance and then make your first start, you've been paying attention to the whole process along the way to get you back to there. And that can give you that sense of confidence and readiness so that you're maybe not having that kind of lingering doubt that you may otherwise have. So yeah, it's definitely it's a tricky process for some people, because that adjustment in terms of where you're, like, how you're setting your goals and where you're deriving your sense of self-worth comes from, that's not easy to do when these are like really, really ingrained habits that have probably been in place for, yeah, you know, years and years, decades at this point, right, for most of these players. And then the other little point just around sort of staying sort of balanced and kind of staying involved in the squad is that also, again, is kind of going to be quite individual. So for some players, actually, I think for a lot of sports people, the instinct is, oh, I want to stay involved. I don't want to feel like I'm missing out. So they will go to training and things like that. But very often that becomes incredibly frustrating, because now you're just sort of stood around watching everyone doing what you want to be doing, right? Mm-hmm. And you're watching the person who's going to start in your spot, going about doing their drills and all the rest of it. And that's always going to be, you know, kind of bad news no matter which way you look at it. Or if you've got the right mindset, or if you've got that kind of mindset, right, you're going to look at them going, either they're not as good as me, this is frustrating, I can't believe they're starting, or you're going to be watching them do really well going, oh man, I don't know if I'm going to get my place back, right? And either way, that's not an ideal place to be. So actually sometimes just kind of removing the source of that frustration, removing the sort of temptation to think in those slightly unhelpful ways, it's probably going to be kind of, yeah, ultimately better actually potentially just to be like, okay, I'm going to come in, I'll do my rehab at the training ground, I'll see everyone, or maybe I'll kind of join people for sort of team meals, but actually I'm then going to kind of head off and do my own thing. And I think probably, yeah, most clubs, I think, would probably have like a reasonable amount of sort of flexibility about like what's going to be best for that player in that situation to kind of like, yeah, make the right choices so that they feel like they're still part of it. They're still getting obviously the technical support and the access to the sort of resources and facilities that they need to recover as quickly as they can. But at the same time, they're not sort of like stuck there with a kind of the grass is greener kind of in their face the whole time.
And I think that exact point is backed up by the fact that I think it was James Maddison was allowed to go abroad to do some of his rehab. He was allowed to take his family abroad with him, and he would still be working really hard, doing his rehab during the day, but then he's in a different environment, probably warmer. It's slightly nicer to do the outdoor work. It's away from everyone else, so there's no kind of watching on enviously. And then also it's you know, special time away with the family as well. So it feels like a bit of a treat in a way to have that,
yeah,
that time. So it's, yeah, that's something that is clearly being thought about at Spurs, which I'm really pleased about.
Yeah, and I think it you know, it's one of those phrases that I have to use kind of quite carefully with clients, right? But like, you know, there probably is some kind of silver lining to some, you know, to pretty much every cloud, right? And so finding what that is and then trying to kind of hone in on that is probably important, you know, like, and so if for Madison, that was, oh, okay, right, I'm injured. I obviously don't want to be injured. I'd much rather be playing football, but the silver lining is I get to go and spend a couple of weeks with my family in the sun. Hey, that's something I wouldn't have been able to do at this point in my life. So, hey, that's pretty great. You know, and so actually, yeah, I think I really liked that. I also really liked that Ange was quite, was very protective of I think a journalist asked about it being a holiday or something, and Ange sort of jumped on them and was like, no, it's not a holiday. He's out there recovering. He just happens to be doing it somewhere sunnier. Like, and I thought that was just really interesting as well. That, yeah, he's even under those situations, you know, Ange is there like very much sort of like protecting the players in those moments. And again, I think that just speaks to his authenticity and I guess to the other half of the question about the injuries was around sort of how it maybe impacts the team dynamics. And I think one of the things that was very impressive about Ange in particular through that was that he didn't flinch. He never used it as an excuse for poor performances. And again, I think that was just something about his sort of his own willingness to take responsibility for that. I think there are impacts potentially on some of the dynamics that then happen. And I think that's a really interesting angle as well. And that would be in terms of what sports psychology may or may not be doing in those circumstances is going to depend a lot on what the setup is within each and every individual club. But, you know, I think, again, from the sort of outsider's perspective, seeing what Ange was saying in press conferences and so on sort of suggested to me that he was probably trying pretty hard to kind of manage those expectations of within the club of and within the players of sort of like trying to set expectations correctly, you know, still being incredibly ambitious. And that was what he was always saying in his press conferences is like, I'm going to select a team that I think can win regardless of who's available or not. But yeah, trying to, you know, just instill within those players, you know, like, well, this is your opportunity. This is your chance to step up. You know, everyone here is should be able to kind of make this work. Essentially, like, everyone here is a capable footballer who can step in, you know, as and when. But that's really tricky. And I think there's another question in the running order potentially about sort of like losing our heads and getting rattled. And I think that may also have factored in a little bit in the injury or the losing the injuries probably factored into some of those matches where we have lost our heads or made silly mistakes or even just sort of like made obvious kind of howlers of individual mistakes. Is I think that when you do have that inconsistency of a lineup, you don't have that chance to build a really clear kind of relationship with the people around you on the pitch who you interact with most often. I think there is a chance that you don't necessarily you don't know how much you can trust the person next to you or whatever. And I think there's probably been moments when, you know, we've had players kind of lunge in for silly tackles, thinking particularly of I think Bissouma was guilty of one, kind of lunged into a tackle that immediately got quite widely criticized as like being very stupid, like completely reckless, very needless. But he was playing with a completely unfamiliar back line at that point. And so I think there's definitely a possibility that he was sat there thinking, if I don't get that ball, I don't know for sure whether this results in a goal or not, you know, or a clear goal scoring opportunity. So I think he may have thought, I think I've got the skills to just about get away with this. It's slightly higher risk than I would like it to be, but at the same time, it's probably worth it because this way I can, if I get it right, I can end the problem now rather than making it someone else's problem. And I think that speaks to, again, some of those issues potentially where you don't have the people around you that you're as familiar with.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So So the question about losing heads was from Lee Fraser. So specifically, he said, with such a young squad and with the two vice captains of a squad getting involved and sucked into the shenanigans too, what approach can the coaches take to get the team to adapt to the game state in a positive way? And I think it's relating to Morpay and the Brentford game, where Maddison really got properly sucked in and Ange was quite cross with him about that, I think. But these things happen in football. You know, you do have running battles on the pitch and it's kind of inevitable. Do you think there's anything that the coaches could do to encourage them not to be sucked in?
Yeah, it's such a tricky one, right? Because first of all, as a fan, you're like, ah, this is brilliant, right? When you see the players afterwards kind of like mocking Mopé with the with the dart celebrations and things. I think from the you can understand it in a lot of ways, because obviously, or you can understand the frustration potentially from Ange's perspective in terms of these are professionals and this is their job. And I think you can argue that that's probably not super helpful from a performance perspective, right? You do want players sort of remaining calm. We spoke a little bit already about the sort of the idea of trying to get yourself into that ideal headspace to perform, and you kind of want to then stay there, and that's tricky at the best of times. But if you've got someone who's been kind of, you know, winding you up, if you then go and equalize and score a late winner and all the rest of it, like, of course you're going to be excited about that, and you might choose to kind of have a moment to unload and kind of celebrate in a way that is perhaps a little bit silly or cheeky, or, you know, maybe not fully professional, I guess. In terms of what you could specifically be doing about it, that I think is quite a delicate balance, because you obviously want people to be enjoying what they're doing, right? And people get into professional football because they really love playing football, right? For the most part, like, that's why you end up doing it, is that it's just something you enjoy, and you don't really want to take away that enjoyment, because you don't want them running around like kind of mindless robots. You know, it's important that they enjoy the process of going out there and doing what they do, because otherwise all the negativity, all the pressure or whatever becomes kind of completely untenable, right? You need to be balancing that with the satisfaction of going out and doing things well. But I think that's probably where that balance then starts to tip over, right? Is like, are you enjoying the kind of the actual processes, I guess, right, of performing well, doing the things that you need to be doing, executing the skills that you've been training on, you know, helping your teammates, enjoying that kind of more, what the word we would use in psychology is this, like, slightly sort of more intrinsic things of kind of like that sense of just sort of developing your sense of value and self-worth and all the rest of it through noticing the good things that you're doing to learn and develop and execute, rather than the more extrinsic or external things of like, ha ha ha, I've just made that guy look like an idiot, you know, which is very tempting, is very human, is very understandable, but is probably generally not quite as helpful. But the research on kind of motivation and things like that of like intrinsic versus extrinsic says that like you can have a bit of both. You just don't want to be fully focused on those external goals, whether that's winning matches or winning trophies or winning personal kind of accolades or winding up your opponents. If you're only focused on those or too focused on those, that ultimately can be kind of unhelpful. It's also one of those things that is tricky, because, you know, I mean, football is obviously an unbelievably complicated game. If you think about the amount of mental processing power that goes into, you know, even just a split second of a football match, where like there's you, there's your 10 other teammates, there's 11 opposition, there's a referee, there's weather conditions, there's a ball traveling with spin and all the rest of it, right? And you're trying to judge where you need to be, what you're going to do, how you're going to interact with all of your teammates in a way that's going to outmaneuver all of the people on the opposite team, right? Like, I mean, the processing power required for that is just phenomenal. You really need to be dedicating, yeah, and the human brain has a limit to how much it can process, right? Just like a computer or a phone or whatever, right? So if you overload it or give it too many kind of non-essential tasks to focus on, like, if I do this, will it annoy that guy? You run the risk of actually being detrimental to your own performance, right? Because actually that's brain power that you probably could or should have been putting into something more directly game focused. So I think, so I guess if you're working on that basis, and that is your genuine kind of motivation and how you're processing and how you're performing, right, is like, okay, if I do this, this, and this, that's what the coach has told me, that's what I think is going to help, that's what we've been practicing, that's what I'm going to feel proud of myself for, and the ball goes in the back of the net. And then in that moment when you've got a bit of free brain power because the match isn't happening because the ball's in the back of the net, you decide to be a bit silly. I'm kind of all right with that. But if that has been kind of a bit of a distraction along the way, that's obviously when it becomes a little bit more problematic. So I think just so long as there's kind of like, I think that's probably where I'd be coming at that from, would be like, okay, like there can be a bonus, almost like a byproduct is you're going to annoy your opposition, right? But that's not the goal, right? And actually, arguably in sports psychology, a lot of the time, you would even talk about the result of the match itself in that context of like, if you do the right things, if you play the right passes, if you make the right movements, all the rest of it, that should be what you're deriving your sense of pride from. That's what you've been practicing for. If you keep doing that in the right way over and over and over again, more often than not, the ball will go in the right net, more often than it goes in the wrong net, and you'll win more matches than you lose, and you'll get more points, and then you'll end up higher in the table. But that's kind of generally how you'd want to sort of think about it. It's like, do the processes right and everything else follows. But again, almost like a byproduct or a bonus of doing the right things on the pitch when you're meant to do them. And winding up your opponents is probably another little fun bonus point that comes out of that as well.
I think Morpay is a really useful case study in this, in everything you've just described, because obviously we understand now the purpose of him doing this. He wants to distract, he wants to use up the opponent's brain power on things that don't help their own performance. But in doing so, he is distracting from his own performance. And perhaps if he spent a little less time trying to wind up the opposition and a little bit more time focusing on his own abilities, he might have scored a few more goals over the years. But
yeah,
who am I to judge?
And it can backfire even more than that, right? So it can not only impact your own performance because you're not paying attention to things you arguably should be, but also if you're putting that time and energy into trying to wind up your opponent and they don't, well, you can end up being frustrated by that as well, because you're like, yeah, oh, but I'm doing all the right things, like quote unquote right things, right? I'm doing all the right things to wind them up and they're still cool as a cucumber. What can I be doing more? Why is this not working? And then you actually have added almost an element of frustration to your own game because your wind-up techniques aren't working and they're not having the effect that you want, right? And if you've got if you've kind of backed yourself into a corner where like that's a kind of core part of your game, if it doesn't work, that's really a problem, because now you've just got this like really cool, calm, collected like opponent who's your sort of opposite number or whatever, who's got your number, like they're making you play in a way that is uncomfortable for you, and so you've kind of ended up in a position where that's then really tricky.
Nice. So moving on to the next question, this one is from Toby Hall, who said, Spurs have apparently signed an exciting young Swede, which got me thinking about the step up that young players are often expected to make, not just physically but also psychologically. Can Alex dig into a bit of the kinds of psychological challenges that young players face when they're signed by a big club like Spurs, bigger than Barcelona, don't you know? And this ties in very nicely to your new area of research, I think, Alex. So is there anything you can offer Toby by means of reassurance around the step up that Bergvall might have to take?
Yeah, I think so this ties in a little bit more to where my doctoral research is now headed. It's interesting because there's a sort of little niche within sports psychology of looking at these sort of like career transitions, and this kind of junior to senior ranks is kind of identified as one of those sort of moments where there's a real change in expectations, and it's a really tricky one to navigate, and it's sort of the kind of thing that it's largely unavoidable if that's the career path you're on. And that doesn't necessarily always have to be within professional athletes, right? It's true kind of at any level of any sport, is like, if you're trying to go from those kind of junior ranks where it's sort of all maybe a little bit more casual to the sort of like, oh, well, here we are in the sort of the big bad senior ranks, right? And there's also a difference. There's often a very big difference where actually it goes from being like, you just have to be the best in your year, right? So you can be the best under 10, then the best under 11, then the best under 13 or whatever, right? You're only in a pool that's as big as that year. And then all of a sudden you're in the senior ranks where it covers 10 plus years. And so all of a sudden you're just in a bigger pool of characters anyway. And regardless of the fact that those people, you know, a lot of those people have more experience and all the rest of it. Like, so that's a huge, huge difference a lot of the time anyway, is just that you're suddenly competing against a much broader number of individuals. It is challenging. And I think it's one of the, well, I think just in general, like there's a lot of football fans and even a lot of sort of football punditry and commentary and journalism fails to take into account, you know, that there can be a real difference in terms of physical maturity and psychological or mental maturity. And by maturity, I don't mean that they are kind of mature as a sort of character trait of being sort of sensible, but like just the development rates there. And that, you know, it's, you know, a lot of, you know, the human brain doesn't finish developing until sort of potentially mid-20s in a lot of cases. And so, and that isn't necessarily tied to how physically mature they are. So you can have someone who at 18, 19 looks, you know, looks like Luke Littler, or, you know, looks like they need to be shaving, you know, twice a day and all the rest of it, but they actually may not have the same mental maturity, mental development at that point. So that's always tricky to navigate, and is quite hard also to sort of justify, or sorry, I'm not justify, but sort of evaluate, I guess, and quantify even. You can kind of look at two physical human beings and say, oh, okay, these are both 18, but that one kind of looks 16 and that one looks 22. That's kind of slightly, there are easier metrics to measure that potentially than kind of going, okay, well, where are we in terms of sort of brain development and so on? And the issues that sort of face a player in that situation are obviously really different as well. And the pressure that comes with that step up is often huge. Learning how to navigate that. I mean, to some extent, it comes back to topics we've already sort of spoken about a little bit, of just sort of like focusing on doing the right things, right? Learning the processes and concentrating your efforts on trying to sort of celebrate when those go well. And, you know, so that if you are training with the first team and you're doing a good job there, that's probably all that's going to be asked of, you know, Bergvall and a lot of the other sort of academy players who've maybe been training with the first team, particularly during the injury crises that we've had, you know, like is if you are there and you are being told you're doing a good job by Ange or the other, you know, the assistant coaches or whatever, that's probably all that's being expected of you. And you're not actually being called on to play matches or get minutes, right? So kind of just take that almost at face value, but make sure that you're really celebrating that for what it is, rather than getting too caught up in the sort of direct comparisons of, well, am I getting minutes? Am I doing this? You know, all the rest of it. Like, because that's, you know, you're there for a reason. And that reason may well just be kind of exposure and learning and developing. And I think also that then there's also a lot to be said for the way that actually sort of not throwing some of these players in at the deep end, right? And we've, you know, with, you know, Brendan Johnson, who is also quite, you know, quite young, although maybe not kind of 18, but has, because of, you know, partly because of the injuries that we've had, has played a lot of games, quite, you know, important games when there weren't a lot of other options. So he's had to play a lot of minutes. And that's really difficult potentially, right? Because then you do have these other elements that get kind of thrown into the mix, rather than just being able to, or that you can be tempted to overemphasize, right? So rather than just being like, hey, I'm a relatively young player who's playing with, you know, with the first squad of a kind of top six Premier League team, like, isn't that awesome? Isn't that amazing? And actually I'm getting really good feedback from the manager and the assistant coaches, who are telling me I'm doing all the things that are expected. And hey, I've been rewarded with the opportunity to start this weekend. But then you come off the back of that and you're like, well, did I do enough? Did I score enough goals? Did I create enough assists? Did I do this? Did I do that? Whereas actually, on the face of it, a lot of, you know, not just Johnson, but, you know, all of these players are kind of, they're sort of living the dream in a lot of ways, but it can be easy to overlook that and kind of underemphasize the fact that actually a lot of what's happening here is really, really, really good, and that you should be kind of trying to focus more on those. And that's just a trick of how the human brain tends to work. Almost all of us are subject to various sort of cognitive biases and things like that, where we overemphasize the things that we've done wrong or the mistakes that we've made, and underappreciate the things that we're good at or the things that we did well. And we are also incredibly bad at remembering how far we've come on a development journey. So again, almost coming back to the injury thing, right? It's like, it's important to remember where you started in a process so that you can really fully celebrate how far you've come. And the human brain is really bad at that. We are constantly kind of rewriting history. Oh yeah, I always knew how to do that. Like, well, what? No, you didn't. Obviously you didn't. Like, you had to learn how to do that as well. So I think there's a lot that can be done there of just sort of trying to remind these players that you know, they don't need to be starting every match. They don't need to be scoring and assisting or whatever the right metric is for their position. You know, that actually a lot of what's been happening is really great for them, and that's what they need to be sort of focusing on and deriving their sort of motivation and confidence from, rather than getting caught up in the sort of, I guess, the kind of narratives and stats that potentially are kind of more how fans and commentators and pundits and journalists and all the rest of it kind of evaluate performance. I think actually trying to sort of almost disregard as much of that as possible is probably quite helpful in that process.
So interesting. I think I'm just thinking about, as you were speaking, I was thinking about Jamie Donnelly and the kind of how he would have felt being in the under-21s in a restricted age group, and how he was very much the guy. He was like the one that they would pass to get them a goal or get them out of trouble, or even just to sort of reset the attacking move they're on when it's not quite going right, or when they're under pressure, they can give the ball to Donnelly and know it's secure. So being the guy in an emotional sense, I suppose, but also in an actual on the football pitch sense, and then stepping up and not being the guy in either of those ways. Like, of course, I don't know, James Maddison doesn't think that Jamie Donnelly is the guy to give the ball to get a goal. That would be completely unreasonable. But also, like, he's just not receiving the ball as much because other players are the guy at that level. And so naturally he's not having as many touches. So the impact that must have on a player is really significant. And it just makes me admire Dele even more, because he made that transition look completely seamless. And Kane as well, I suppose, is another really good example. And I guess it's just about kind of keeping grounded and focusing on what should come if you're making all the right process steps in your own preparation for hopefully being the guy in the future.
Yeah, I do also think that, you know, having spoken about how like individual players can forget how far they've come and what the fair benchmarks are for performance, I do think as a fan base we've totally lost all perspective, partly because of Dele, that he we bought him for such a tiny fee, and like we loaned him back to
MK Dons, was it?
MK Dons. And then like when he joined the team in the summer, like he was starting within like a couple of months and was like undroppable, getting England caps like within the first half of the season, scoring worldies for fun, right? And I think now for like a lot of Spurs fans, they're like, well, why isn't Brennan Johnson as kind of good value as Dele was? And even if they kind of like try to adjust a little bit, like the bar was set so high with Dele in those first two or three seasons where he was just unbelievably good. Like, I mean, he was kind of far and away the best sort of young player in the Premier League, like, and arguably one of the best in the entire world, right? And I think even if you try and adjust that down a little bit in the name of fairness on our other junior players, you're still so far above what the average kind of expectation would be for a player of that age and level making that step up. I hope that the Spurs fans can kind of, as a collective, we can start to kind of like process a little better of what we can be getting from some of these younger players who we've signed or who we're bringing through the academy, because they're not going to be Dele. Like, literally, like, they're just not. It was quite astonishing how good he was, and expecting these players to even be half as good as Dele was in his first season would still probably be an unbelievably good return on most of them.
Amazing point. Yeah, such a good point. I knew this podcast was going to be a long one because please don't apologize. I love it. I love these conversations. And I think we're going to have to come back to some of the questions, but I do want to cover Richarlison with you. It's very topical at the moment. And we had a question from Danny S, who himself is a therapist who works with young people. And Danny says that there's, it's quite a long question, but I'll go to the end. He says, how does this play out with clubs seeking mental health support for players? Is the role of the sports psychologist to support sporting success or support overall wellness? It all feels a little like HR being there for the employees. And Richarlison is a really interesting case because he has spoken openly about his mental health struggles recently, which is still relatively unusual in football, certainly at top level football. And he has been really clear about why it's unusual for someone who comes from where he comes from to talk openly and to seek support. Now, I'm very keen to emphasize that you are a sports psychologist and you're not a psychotherapist, and so your role is very different. But do you have much to offer on the subject of Richarlison and specifically Danny's question?
I think it's a really interesting question, and I think Richarlison is a super interesting and hopefully a really, really helpful example. I guess more broadly to the question, then I might come back to Richarlison specifically, but I think it's an area where there definitely can be a tension between like the sort of sporting performance and kind of overall mental health and well-being. As a sports psychologist, yes, there are boundaries to what we can kind of officially sort of deal with. That tends to be one of the, I guess, the sort of quote unquote clearest kind of limits to that would be around sort of like actual kind of diagnosable mental health conditions. So like at that point, we would seek to refer, like if we would, we're sort of trained to identify symptoms of that, but like we're not in a position to directly diagnose or help, you know, treat, I guess. So like if you're working with someone and you become suspicious that they've got kind of a sort of diagnosable kind of depression or anxiety or any other sort of mental health condition, right, we're meant to refer them on to either a clinical psychologist or to a psychiatrist or whatever that happens to be. That can be a bit of a gray area in and of itself. So there's often sort of ethical kind of dilemmas that can kind of come up in those situations, particularly if you've been working with a client for a while, they have a connection with you, they maybe don't love the idea of working with someone else. And so there can be a bit of a sort of bridging period where you're like, well, I'm pretty sure there's something else going on here, and I would like you to get that additional help, but I'm also not going to, like, I can't cut you loose. I can't force your hand into doing that either. So in the meantime, I will obviously continue to support you in the best way that I can, while knowing that I'm not really trained to do so. So there's definitely can be some gray areas there. More generally though, you know, there's actually potentially less of a tension than there might officially be. It's one of those things where when you're kind of starting out in your sports psychology kind of training and you're learning about this, it's a kind of classic example of, oh, well, what would you do in this situation? I think it actually possibly comes up slightly less often than people might think, because actually generally a happy athlete is a successful athlete and vice versa. So actually if you've got someone who is not feeling great about themselves in whatever way, shape or form in a sort of more general sense, that's probably also going to have a knock-on effect on their performance. So you can, and when you're talking about high level elite or professional athletes, though, as I already said, right, those two things tend to be really, really closely linked, right? Their identity is tied to their sport and their sport is tied to their identity, and their well-being is tied to all of those and all the rest of it. So if you can work on the performance element, that may have an impact on their general sense of mental well-being as well. Or it may be that you feel like you can work on some of the other areas and that actually improves the well-being, the performance as well. So there's a bit of a sort of chicken and egg situation there. And as the sports psychologist, you may end up having to kind of test the waters to see where the right place to start is in order to kind of essentially help out on both sides of that equation. How do you get them feeling better about the performances and feeling better about themselves more generally? That being said, that it may also be a case that in some situations you want to find additional resources who can help with one side of that, so that you've got someone working more on the sort of the general well-being, general mental health, and then you're working more specifically on the performance side of things. So it can be tricky. You just ultimately, you kind of want someone, you're more often than not, I would say, if you can get them feeling better about their performances, it's probably going to have a decently, you know, helpful impact on their well-being, or the other way around. So actually, often they go hand in hand. I think they probably go hand in hand, perhaps more often than they do in the other sports sciences. So like, if you've got someone who's playing through an injury, then there is a real question of like, is there a well-being case here where actually the injury may get worse the more we play them? So should we be dropping them for a couple of matches and letting them recover, or do we let them play through and hope that it gets better? In psychology, actually, particularly if what you're working on is, you know, as you can imagine, like a lot of the things are ultimately going to come back to, I don't feel like I'm performing well enough in matches. Like I'm not representing myself. I'm not showing how good I am in training potentially. Then you kind of do still more, again, rule of thumb, but more often than not, you're still going to want the people out there performing in matches. So it's not going to be helpful to be like, oh, you don't feel like you're converting your training form into match day form. Well, let's drop you from matches, because that's not going to give you any opportunity to test out new things. So what I would be doing in that situation is trying to give the players certain tools or skills or certain things to sort of think about and work on that they can be working on potentially in training and between matches, but also certain things that they can be then working on during the matches themselves. So, but you still need them in that environment to test them out. They're obviously not going to work instantly. There's no magic wand, but you kind of need to give them that exposure to those situations so that they can be trying those new things and hoping that they start to have that positive effect. So again, there's probably, and that's not true for a physical injury where you'd be like, oh, well, we've done some physiological tests and you're in the red zone for this, and therefore you can't just sort of like play your way out of that necessarily. So it's going to be a case of like, actually, we need you to ease back. In psychology, it's perhaps a little bit different there.
That makes so much sense. Yeah, I wouldn't have thought about it in those terms before, but it does make complete and utter sense. And did you want to say anything specifically about Richarlison? We had a brief chat about him before we started recording, and I think we're both full of admiration for his approach.
Yeah, for sure. I think so much of what he's kind of said and done is really helpful broadly for my profession. But I think it's helpful for everyone. Like, just to be quite open about the struggles that he's had and the fact that he sought help is really, really useful. And I think what's particularly kind of unique about his case is that, as far as I'm aware, he has done all of that voluntarily. Like, he opted kind of purely through his own kind of will, he chose to share that information. And I think that's quite different to other situations. Thinking about players, you know, there are players out there who it is known that they have had struggles with their mental health. And I'll also just throw out there that addiction falls into that category as well. So I think there was a weirdly bipolar or weirdly sort of like partisan take on Tony's return for Brentford, where some people it's possible Sky slightly overdid it, but also like, this is someone who is battling a mental health issue and has returned from that. And I think that actually is worthy of some celebration, maybe not quite as much as they gave it, but it is definitely worthy of celebration.
Completely agree.
But when you think about either him, right, like his story only came to light, his issues with addiction came to light because he was banned, right? Aaron Lennon, Dele, Jadon Sancho, right? Like, these are players who, it's widely known, it's kind of out there as public information that these people have struggled with various forms of mental health or mental ill health or whatever. But in all of those cases, that information was sort of put out there either by other people or the situation was forced by other circumstances. So certainly like when Dele gave that amazing interview, like he basically came out and said like, the tabloids were going to just publish this without my consent. So I just wanted to get out in front of it and share the information on my own terms. And that is still unbelievably brave for him to do that, but it's also completely disgraceful, and that's the situation that these people are being put in. And I would argue that that's perhaps even more the case with Jadon Sancho. So all of those people kind of had their arms twisted to divulge that information, and seemingly, you know, I think it would probably be fair to say that without those external kind of triggers or pressures, they probably wouldn't have done so. Whereas actually, it seems like Richarlison, as far as I'm aware, I've not seen anything that he has kind of felt kind of coerced to share this information. He seems to have just shared it very freely. And I think that that's a kind of testament to him as an individual. Like, he again also seems very authentic as a human being. And I think he has just sort of like seen this as an opportunity to kind of do some good by sharing that this has been a helpful thing for him. Also, obviously, he's had the physical sort of renaissance that's come with his surgery and all the rest of it. So it's slightly hard to unpick what how much is one and how much is the other. But I think him coming forward and saying all of that has been extremely brave and extremely impressive. And I really, really hope that that kind of sets a bit more of a precedent for other players to kind of share more openly in a way that doesn't feel like they've been forced to do that. But also, you know, I think the reception generally of Richarlison doing that has also been helpful. And it's been helpful that his form has then picked up. That helps that helps a lot to make it seem like, oh, I did this thing and it was really helpful, so maybe others should consider doing the same thing. But it's great to see someone out there sort of flying the flag for any form of kind of working on your own mental health and well-being, and then that having a knock-on effect, you know, in terms of those sort of improvements in performance as well.
Mm-hmm. Very well said, Alex. I feel very proud of Richarlison for being a leader in this area, and long may it continue. And I hope that what he's done is also something that goes on to help other players, and more importantly, potentially people who read his story and hear what he's saying and understand that there's help out there if you seek it. We've massively overrun, as we always do. It's been hugely appreciated. I think I would love to get you back on, because we had other questions from Dr. Tottenham and Yankoslav, who had asked really interesting questions as well. And if anyone else has any questions they'd like to put forward to Alex, please just email us podcast@theextrainge.co.uk, or if you're on the Discord, please feel free to drop them in the podcast questions channel, and we'll get Alex back on to tackle more questions. But thank you so much, Alex. It's been such a brilliant insight into all of these scenarios and areas. It's really appreciated.
You're very welcome. Always a pleasure to come on and chat.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.